Hello everyone, this is Thomas J. Pucher speaking, the president of FalconCrest.org. I'm glad you are back for another one of my audio commentaries. I recorded this one for the 42nd anniversary of the show's premiere, December the 4th, 2023. I'd like to guide you through For Better or For Worse today, which is one of the most thrilling episodes of Season 3, maybe even the most suspenseful one of the first 3 years. But you have to find that out for yourself. Before we start, I want to let you know that you can use our behind-the-scenes section on the website like a commentary while watching each episode. In my audio commentaries, I don't repeat all the stuff from there, and I'll also throw in some additional details here and there that are not on the website, since this is more of a review and what I personally think about this episode. So put in your DVD from Warner Home Video and turn down the volume a bit. I'll tell you when to push the play button, so you can listen to my audio commentary while playing the episode. Okay, so please press play now. In the sneak preview, we are taken right into the center of the episode's storyline, Julia's determination to kill her mother. We remember from the previous episode that Julia has come to the Tuscany Valley to bury her mother. So that's what this episode is all about. Will she succeed? Or will somebody stop her? And Father Bob might be the key because he knows from her confession. And the other scenes give us an idea of how Julia wants to kill Angela, dressed in a nun's habit, sneaking into the church where her mother's wedding ceremony takes place, as what we love to call the nun with a gun. So here's a gorgeous main title shot of Jane, specifically filmed. It's the outfit she wears in episode 44. That's the fourth episode of season 3, Partners. And as usual, the main title has all these beautiful shots from San Francisco and the wine country in Northern California. Mel Ferrer made it to the regular cast this year after being a special guest in seasons 1 and a semi-regular in season 2, and Margaret Ladd was also promoted to a regular. And one of the main title shots of Susan that became so iconic here, spinning her head around for this, just gorgeous. By the way, FalconCrest never had the problem with the credit order in the main title, which was at the producer's discretion. There was a lot more friction on other Lorimar shows because certain cast members were constantly fighting for a better position in the main title, which eventually led Lorimar bosses to just sorting them in an alphabetical order, like on Dallas, Nuts Landing, and Flamingo Road, but not a problem on FalconCrest at all, not even with Foxworth. So here we are, diving into Act 1. Writer Ellis Marcus was supervising producer Ann Marcus's husband, by the way. Julia's storyline is incredible, I think. Every other show probably would have gotten rid of a murderess, sending her away to prison, or back in the day, have her end up in the gas chamber or with a deadly injection, but not FalconCrest. I think it's incredibly beautiful what the writing staff accomplished with this character. I mean, not only did they find a terrific way to keep her involved in the plot, constantly raising the question if she was mentally unstable, criminally insane, but they also managed to write her character in a way that we as the audience still really feel for her. I mean, isn't that something? She's a murderess, and we still care for her because we also know what she's been going through in her life. With this ultra-dominant mother, with the lack of a decent relationship and the loss, if you will, of her son to her mother at a very young age, and the only focus on her work as the enologist of FalconCrest. Now, this is fun in a way. I mean, who would have thought that Angela would ask Maggie to become her matron of honor at her wedding, and Joseph the ring bearer. But despite Angela's disdain for Chase, she always liked Maggie, I think. Especially when Maggie had the brain tumor. I think Angela's concern for her was real. So that's interesting, because it's not one of Angie's usual schemes, but she's really honest, and she wants Maggie to be there at her wedding, right by her side. I really like that scene. Cole is pretty surprised too. But Angie really cared for that little boy as well. Here's St. Timothy Church of Tuscany Valley, apparently a vast church and convent complex in the hills above the valley. The Virgin Mary statue is real, but the sign is a prop Lorimar brought in for filming, of course. This is Mary Chapel at Mount St. Mary's University, back then Mount St. Mary's College, high above Brentwood in the greater Los Angeles area. The campus is very photogenic, which is why the location scouts from the movie industry have been trying to get location agreements with the nuns running the university for decades. And the campus was on countless shows, including one of the earliest episodes of Desilus, now Paramount's original Mission Impossible TV series, and years after Falcon Crest, it became the high school in the OC. To the front of Mary Chapel is a beautifully landscaped circle with a fountain in the center, and colonnades lead from either side of Mary Chapel to the university's various halls. If you want to learn more about this filming location and many others, you can get our Falcon Crest travel guide. Now, here's the key scene we've already gotten a sneak peek of in the preview before the main title. And note that there is different footage of the same scene. Because the sneak preview and the scene itself is slightly different. Something that Falcon Crest did quite often, which meant less superfluous footage, if you will. You can't imagine how many repeats of scenes are taken when filming an episode. There is so much waste. But back to the storyline here. Julia's confession lays the groundwork for one of the core elements of this episode. Father Bob gets into this incredible dilemma. Will he have to break the seal of confession? Can he betray Julia and just ignore the seal of confession because a human being is in grave danger, at risk to be murdered? Well, it's needless to say that the fact that the possible victim is Angela makes this even more difficult, since Father Bob, as we will learn in the course of the series, has always had a good relationship with the Gioberti Channing family. And this is the first time that Bob Curtis, who was, as you all know, a real-life priest, gets a lot more to do on the show. A lot more than just marrying a couple or deliver a speech in a funeral service. He is now fully involved in the storyline, and the acting priest or priestly actor or whatever you may call him does an incredibly good job in this episode. When we see him in later scenes during Angela and Philip's wedding ceremony and reception again, he really convinces in his portrayal of the priest's dilemma and panic. Well, the family dynamics and all the suspense, that's the hallmark of Bob McCullough's way of running the show. He was called supervising producer, but he was, in fact, the showrunner for the first three seasons. This episode here was his last one, although he was formally credited for the two remaining episodes of the season as well. So, for those who are interested in the reasons why Bob left the show, You can read a few details in my interview with him, which can be found in our show interviews section on the website. And we even have a much more detailed interview with him and his wife, actress and writer Suzanne Herrera Macalla, in Volume 1 of our interview newsletter series, Falcon Cresters Tell It All. Our interview newsletter series, by the way, have a lot more details than what we already have on the website in the behind-the-scenes section. So it's always interesting to learn a little bit more about the development, about the goings-on behind the scenes during filming, during the writing and development process. And if you're really interested in the way how the show was developed, we do recommend our newsletter series entitled The Secret Falcon Files, because it focuses on the development stages in the Bibles, which laid the groundwork for each season. It's so much fun to watch Abby Dalton here. She's so good as Julia. The episode is kind of over the top, but that's what all the fun is about. Now look exactly at the sign in this night shot of St. Timothy, or maybe rewatch it later after this commentary and pause your player. As beautiful as this location is, it was probably not the best choice because it had already been used to portray the Couvent Saint-Marthe, St. Martha's Convent near Paris in France, in the season 2 episode The Odyssey. Of course, it's not unusual in the movie industry to use the same location as another setting, but you have to be careful that the viewers won't notice. In this case, the producers probably thought, well, 1 year passed, and in times without home video and with VCRs not being used for archiving things, but primarily for taping something you'd otherwise miss because you were not at home, they probably thought they'd get away with it. But reusing the location is one thing. What they did here is another thing. Although they shot scenes for this episode at Mount St. Mary's, they were unable to shoot at night. Why? Well, I'll tell you a bit later. So, they had no car and night shot with a St. Timothy sign after principal photography for this episode was concluded. So, they had a look through their archived footage from season 2. And found one of the nightly clips that had been unused in the Odyssey. It was propped, however, with a sign reading Couvent Saint-Marthe, Sœur de l'Espérance, which means Convent Saint Martha, Sisters of Hope. So that's the name of the setting in Paris, France, from the episode The Odyssey. But the producers at the time never thought it would be legible because the screen resolution was quite low back then. Nobody would have guessed then that it would become legible in the remastered DVDs. I guess we will even get a much clearer shot, and maybe even more surprises of that kind, when Warner Brothers digitizes their whole film library in HD, which is a project they have been working on for some time now. Some of you may have seen the newly remastered HD picture of the classic Dallas series. I mean, it's amazing. It looks so crystal clear now, as if it had been just filmed yesterday. But already this quality in season 3, with a remastering that they've applied for the DVD release, is quite good in contrast to what we got for seasons 1 and 2 on DVD. Even though it's just an SD remastering that has been applied. So you can only guess from this picture quality how amazing the show will look once it is remastered in HD. This again is the usual trick to combine old Napa Valley footage, this time it was a shot from season 2, with a studio-based veranda segment to create the illusion that the Falcon Crest Victorian Mansion was actually filmed at Spring Mountain. So of course, you will notice the difference if you are an experienced viewer, because the fake veranda scenes are usually filmed very closely, like in this scene. But you know, comparing it with other shows from that time, I think that the Lorimar Productions were quite good at creating realistic exteriors on the soundstage. I mean, just look at the lighting. Lorimar's lighting was really quite good. And remember, this is an era when CGI was not invented yet. Well, maybe we have a couple of minutes now to talk about season 3 in general. This season continued the successful concept of serialized storytelling with cliffhangers for each episode. The show really took off, and season 3 became the most successful season. Falcon Crest was among the top 10 American TV shows in the Nielsen ratings, and was number 7 out of 101 shows in the 1983-84 television season. And this episode was a particularly good one. In the Nielsen ranking, it was number 4 out of 65 shows the week it was originally broadcast in the U.S. Here's Mary-Kate McGeehan. And that gives me the opportunity to speak about a few things from the original Bible for season 3, which was quite different in many aspects from what was finally filmed. The Bible contained a whole background story about Linda's first husband, whom she married while she was studying music in college. While she kept studying, her husband, a soldier, shipped out to Tunisia and was reported killed in a helicopter crash. But his body was never recovered. Needless to say that a soap opera-style return of the not-so-dead hubby was in the producers' heads. But this imposing danger for Linda's marriage with Cole never materialized. I mean, if Linda had stayed longer, this could have been a story twist for a later season, maybe, but we all know what happened after season 3. So Linda's and Cole's marital problems in the final version of the season were the result of the quarrels between Melissa and Joseph. But that's just one example of the many differences in the Bible. And we dedicated a whole newsletter series to these differences. The first 3 seasons are addressed in volume 1 of The Secret Falcon Files, if you're interested. And that newsletter series also includes casting alternatives and a lot more. Here we are in Joseph's nursery in the Victorian mansion, which is currently used by Melissa also, since she moved out of her and Lance's bedroom. And I think I addressed this bedroom set in my audio commentary for the series premiere already. There was only one bedroom set for the mansion to trim down production costs, and due to the limited space on Soundstage 1 at Warner Brothers, or the Burbank Studios as they were called back then, and that set was also moved to CBS, or Radford Studio Center, the following season. And we refer to this bedroom set from the first 4 years as Pattern A. As an experienced viewer, it's not too difficult to recognize that all the bedrooms in the mansion are the same, although they are often filmed from different angles and, of course, redressed whenever it's supposed to be someone else's room. And it becomes more difficult the more changes are applied, such as when it's redressed as an office, And also pretty difficult is recognizing the identity of the nursery, because the access to the room was changed to the other side of the room with the usual door always out of sight when it was filmed as the nursery. Oh, Cliff Robertson. Well, a few words about him. He was a great addition to this season. Wonderful performance, but not easy to work with. Someone from the crew, who wants to remain unnamed, shared the secret about his tan with me. He wasn't actually tanned, but just wanted to look tanned, and requested that his makeup be so dark. It drove the makeup artists and the wardrobe department crazy, because the makeup had to be applied to his hands also. Otherwise, you would have seen a significant difference in the skin tone. So, every hospital scene in a white lab coat with him would drive them nuts, because all the makeup on his hands would come off when he put his hands in his pockets or grabbed anywhere at his coat, like his collar, leaving makeup stains on the white doctor's coat. So they always needed countless spare coats for the countless takes. So here we are at Mount St. Mary's College again, where all the exteriors and a few of the interiors of St. Timothy were shot. The wedding was a big dress call for extras. You know, all these atmosphere people. Many of the usual background players were hired. You must know that the interior scenes of the wedding ceremony and the final cut of the episode are from a different church, while the exteriors and the scenes in the vestibule are from Mount St. Mary's. The ceremony was actually scheduled to be filmed inside Mary Chapel on January the 27th, 1984. But as you can see in the exterior shots after the wedding, there were gusty winds, and that's just an indication of all the wildfires coming from the surrounding hills and canyons, which imposed a threat on the campus that day. So continuing to film there wasn't safe. We have a few more details on our website how tight the time frame for the wedding scene became. Because they only had a few hours to relocate to St. Brendan's in downtown LA and get everything in the can. It was all Father Bob's doing to arrange for filming at St. Brendan's on such short notice. And St. Brendan's, by the way, was also where the famous publicity shot of Julia in the nun's habit outside the church was taken. So that's interesting. Whenever Bob Curtis is looking around, observing, checking if Julia is there, I mean, it's just incredible how he delivers his inner conflict to the audience by not even saying a word. So here he is, looking around. And again, his look is just enough. What a great actor. It's really a wonderful performance here. So this is a great ending of the act. like a mini cliffhanger with this great shot of Julia. I love that Warner Brothers kept the bumper from the original CBS airing for the break between acts 2 and 3 on the master for the DVDs. And this short jingle-like version of the theme is like a musical flourish. It was never released elsewhere. The suspense is really building up here, because you can read from Father Bob's looks how dangerous the situation might get. So when Chase enters, we see the vestibule of St. Timothy, which is actually at Mount St. Mary's, right here. And now let the fun begin. But Julia almost runs into Chase is one of the first super exciting moments in this episode. By the way, this was different footage again. The sneak preview showed her turn around shortly at the staircase. And she didn't do that in the actual scene in the episode because it was from a different take. Mount St. Mary's is apparently a perfect setting for this. The colonnades between Mary Chapel and Brady Hall are not only an eye-catcher, but also give us an idea of how vast the convent campus at St. Timothy is. And this stairway and the long corridors in Brady Hall are really a great choice for the scene when Chase follows Julia. So he's coming closer. The janitor's office, by the way, is a set. It was built on stage 19A at the Burbank Studios, now Warner's. And here she is, the nun with a gun. We all love that term, of course. I think Abby once mentioned that it's actually something that first came from Jane Wyman when she saw Abby in the nun's habit and with a gun on the set for the first time. So, what a great sense of humor. And Abby Dalton again, she's really brilliant. Her performance in this episode is incredibly strong. Chase locked up. Now back to the ceremony. I won't say much here, just a few names of extras who are part of the Valley's High Society for almost all the seasons. far right, far back on the right was Paul Vann, and here is Ian Bruce. Paul Vann appeared in over 50 episodes. So when Julia enters here, we see how windy it was outside. It was very, very difficult for filming. And the tension is building up now. Really building up. Behind Tom Calloway, Dr. Foster is Sherry Zack. With her elegant and aristocratic look. She was maybe the number one socialite in the valley, and she was at almost every festivity, over 40 appearances throughout the show. Great performance as an extra. Oh, and now this is another great moment. The gun's not working. I mean, such dramatic irony. It's all so over the top this episode, but it's so much fun. And now look at this. When they leave the church, how intricately this is cut together. Because the vestibule is a shot from Mount St. Mary's again. While the nave with the ceremony was from St. Brendan's. So here we are in the vestibule at Mount St. Mary's. So now when all the guests are giving their best wishes to Angela and Philip, pay attention to Julie Sells, who comes in from the left in yellow. Now here she is. I'll come back to that extra later. Julia sneaking away, taking Chase's car. Now driving to Falcon Crest. Again, there are many regular extras who worked on the show for many, many episodes in the background, like Buzz Barbee here on the right, the white-haired guy with the glasses. Well, in a moment, Julia will arrive at Falcon Crest, but we never learned how Julia got onto the Falcon Crest property in the Gioberti station wagon and where she parked the car. So when she leaves at the end of the episode, she still has the car. early script drafts had her arrive at a security checkpoint near the gate and deceive the guard by telling him that she was Chase's or Maggie's cousin from New York, and since the car had a wedding guest sticker on the windshield, she was allowed to pass. But that idea never got beyond the script draft. I think Bob McCullough felt that there was no need to explain everything. I mean, Julia was familiar with the vast property, and she probably just found a way in through maybe a little road through the vineyards or whatever. So the newlyweds and guests arriving. Look at the maid on the left. It's Julie Sells again, but she was a wedding guest before, the one in the yellow outfit I pointed out earlier in front of the church. Now this is an unusual angle. The wall on the landing is odd because there should be the second flight of stairs right there. We addressed that issue in detail in our behind the scenes section on the website. And of course there was no second flight of stairs in the set. The view from the foyer just created that illusion. All the upstairs rooms were of course built on ground level on the soundstage. This establishing shot of the mansion is from the vintage years. It's oftentimes reused on the show for party scenes because of all the posh cars on the driveway. The Bentley on the left was Angela's car and the predecessor. Oh, that's a nice, really nice and tender scene, although it's short, between Richard and Maggie. It's very interesting that the writers started this season already to build up the friendship between them, and it's pretty obvious that Richard really cares for Maggie, particularly if we remember his visit in the hospital shortly before her brain surgery. In particular, Ernie Wallengren, who wrote most of the scripts for the show, always felt the great on-screen chemistry between Susan and David, and he was very much aware of future possibilities with these two great characters. And he really handled the development of their relationship very well over a few seasons, growing slowly from friendship to love. Melissa's reference to Miss Lynch reminds me that I wanted to say a few words about Sarah Douglas, who is unfortunately not in this episode because the dramatic cartel storyline resulted in her abduction. But Sarah is one of the additions of season 3, and while she was not part of the Bible and only hired as a guest star on an episodic basis, the producers soon realized that she had great potential. Sarah had a wonderful way to portray Pamela. Just think of her condescending looks in the scenes with Melissa, or all the sarcasm in the scene with when Terry tried to steal her dinner date with Richard at Lucho's in, mid-season. So with all the potential for conflict, it's not surprising that Sarah will be back in season 4. Oh, on the right here in the back is Gordon Hodgins. This is the white-haired guest in the tuxedo near the fireplace. He was already in the church. Now we see him behind Angela. So keep him in mind here on the right behind Angela at the fireplace. Keep him in mind because we will get to see Gordon later again. So, a few words about Laura Johnson. Laura is the other edition of season 3. Her character was in the original Bible, though. But the season 3 groundwork never intended more than a limited appearance for Terry McGovern, which was her original character name until the producers realized that they had already established Hartford as Maggie's maiden name and corrected that. You can read more about the original plans to have Terry teamed up with Richard instead of Michael, who in turn was intended to show some romantic interest in Melissa. It's all in The Secret Falcon Files, Volume 1. The creative forces originally planned to have Richard team up with Terry for a while. And they planned to have Terry leave the Valley towards the end of the season after Richard just drops her. So nobody knows what would have happened to Terry if Cela Ward had been cast, which was the producer's original idea. But Laura Johnson brought such an interesting dimension to the character that Terry was kept. And if you're a fan of Laura's, you must read the interview with Laura that my colleague Sasha Kurtz and I did with her. It's available in volume 2 of our Falcon Cresters Tell It All newsletter series. So this is goodbye for Dr. Foster. Lots of extras in the background again. So when they go up the stairs in a second, I want to address the upstairs hallway of the Victorian mansion. The part directly in front of the bedroom door is part of the usual bedroom set, but it was a bit enlarged for this episode to create the illusion that this part is near the main stairway. We will see that momentarily. So note that the usual stained glass window is visible here too. That was a beautiful prop made by Lorimar to resemble the style of the stained glass windows in Spring Mountain's Villa Mira Valley, like the most prominent one in the staircase. And the prop window, however, was not made of actual glass, of course, but just to look like stained glass. It was used in many different places in the mansion set to create a familiar atmosphere, keeping us guessing, though, if there are many windows of the same kind in different places of the mansion. In season 5, it will be in the background of Susan's main title card. In seasons 6 and 7, when Earl's creator's credit is featured in the main title, and also very blurry in the background during the swirling of wine and the goblet in the main titles of seasons 7 and 8. We will even see it stored away in the gym set of the Victorian mansion's basement in a scene with Chow Lee and Lance in loose cannons in season 6. And I never found out if it was an oversight that they didn't remove it before filming that scene. It was usually used in non-permanent sets, so they had to store it somewhere until it was reused again. And there were even times when it was in associate producer Victoria LaFortune's office. Now back to the storyline. When Maggie suspects that Chase is maybe still at the Board of Supervisors meeting, Angela doesn't think so, mentioning that Hartman and Costello, the chairman and another supervisor, are here at the party. And it's funny that they were written into Angela's dialogue, but casting apparently never cared to hire John Carter and Roger Perry to actually play them in this episode. But with so many guests around, I mean, who can tell? I can assure you, though, that the actors aren't here, but we can always assume that the characters are somewhere in the house, mingling just out of the camera angle. So Father Bob is still torn whether to warn Angela or anyone that Julia is in the valley, and determined to kill Angie. And this moment here is brilliant. And it's the first time that we see Melody McCord in the role of Melody, the waitress who will become the head housemaid in the Victorian mansion. It will take a while until we get to see a scene with Angela calling her Melody. But you have to know the actress started to work on the show this season as a stand-in, but she appears on screen now and then. The guest bedroom is the same set as the nursery, as I explained earlier, and in the 7-day time frame they had for shooting this episode, the construction crew had to make sure that this room was dressed one day as the nursery and the other day as the bedroom. This issue also illustrates why movies and TV shows are usually filmed in a way that their scenes are not in sequential order when shooting. Instead, you have to get all the scenes in the can that are set in the nursery so you can redress the set for another shooting day when all the segments in the guest bedroom can be filmed, for example. For our members, we have floor plans of all the redresses of this bedroom set in a subsection of our show production office menu, and of course, there are blueprints of many more sets available there. And now the dramatic countdown to this episode's finale. Abby's performance this season has been so incredible. I mean, all the scenes in prison and at the hospital for the criminally insane, how Abby managed to convince us of Julia, going through episodes of psychosis, such as reciting from the Jabberwocky and waking up from a nightmare in the psychiatric hospital in earlier episodes, leaving us, the audience, wondering if she's really a lunatic. On the other hand, we see her love for Joseph here, right here in this scene, just in a second. The alleged grandchild she has loved so much, only to find out he's not Lance's child. But she still loves the little boy. And it's just brilliant, brilliant. An incredible performance, you know? Look at her face. So the usual stained glass window, it's here and it's there. In another moment, it's there. I mean, you see, it's now in the hallway in front of the nursery as the set has been rearranged and redressed. Now Gordon Hodgins is on the right back there as a deputy suddenly. Remember, he was in a tux earlier as a wedding guest. And they also added on parts of the upstairs hallways specifically for the last few minutes of the episode. And these parts were built that way not only to create an almost labyrinth-like setting of corridors leading to the back stairway, which is referenced in dialogue only, but also out of necessity because they had to squeeze these hallways into the limited space on the soundstage. And we addressed the mismatches in the editing of the hallway scenes in our behind-the-scenes section. So these final scenes on the old Tuscany highway were not shot within the 7-day schedule of this episode, but actually during principal photography for the following episode. Logistics are always an issue, so it was easier to film them in one day at Griffith Park, which is not far from Warner Brothers Studios. A specialty of Falcon Crest is this closing credit between Act 4 and the end credits. I think I've never seen that on another show, you know. The way an actor is billed on screen is part of the negotiation for compensation. So it's not only the salary a cast member and their agent might be interested in, but also the specific credit, meaning the position and maybe a certain title. And Cliff Robertson had a season-long appearance, but the producers didn't consider him a regular, so he got this very special credit that caught everyone's attention. And the same will be the case with Morgan Fairchild in the 5th season. Well, thanks for rewatching this exciting episode with me. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and let me know your thoughts on this audio commentary, and feel free to reach out to us via email at production.office@falconcrest.org with any questions you might have. I'm Thomas J. Pucher, president of FalconCrest.org. Thank you so much for your interest. Hope you'll join me again next time.